This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the substance and politics of the framework deal between Iran and the P5 plus one.
After many months of tough, principled diplomacy, we have achieved the framework for that deal. And it is a good deal, a deal that meets our core objectives.
Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. As hard as it was to reach this landmark deal hailed by President Obama to curb Iran's nuclear program, overcoming the political obstacles on both sides of the Atlantic to reach a final comprehensive deal may prove even more daunting. Selling the deal to the U.S. Congress, assuaging skittish Sunni Gulf states and Israel, as well as taking into account internal Iranian politics, may prove as challenging as finalizing the deal. And let's be clear, the deal is not yet done, and many hurdles remain between now and the June 30th deadline. But Iranian President Hassan Rouhani praised the framework deal and said that Iran would honor all of its pledges in the agreement, as long as the other side honors its promises as well. And while ordinary Iranians celebrated in the streets about the prospects of sanctions relief and a thaw in U.S.-Iranian relations, we have not yet heard from Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, who has the ultimate say over the contours of the final deal. President Obama laid out the ways in which the agreement would verifiably block Iran's pathway to nuclear weapons for at least 15 years.
This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran will face strict limitations on its program, and Iran has also agreed to the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated for any nuclear program in history. So this deal is not based on trust. It's based on unprecedented verification.
Such assurances have not seemed to assuage many who are skeptical. Israel, the U.S. Congress, or the Sunni Gulf states, who also decry Iran's rising role in the region, whether in Syria, Iraq, or Yemen. Still, President Obama vowed that stringent verification would make it almost impossible for Iran to pursue a covert path to nuclear weapons.
If Iran cheats, the world will know it. If we see something suspicious, we will inspect it. Iran's past efforts to weaponize its program will be addressed. With this deal, Iran will face more inspections than any other country in the world.
In short, to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon or stop it from getting one clandestinely or quickly, the P5 plus one negotiators have compromised over allowing Iran to continue to enrich uranium, but have sought strict limits on its enrichment program, as well as on the redesign of a plutonium-producing heavy water reactor. Their aim has been to extend Iran's so-called breakout capability, the key yardstick of time needed to produce enough fissile material for one nuclear weapon, from the current estimate of a couple of months to at least 1 year, and to maintain it there for at least a decade or more. In return, Iran would get phased relief from U.S., European Union, and U.N. sanctions that have crippled its economy. Again, President Obama.
In return for Iran's actions, the international community has agreed to provide Iran with relief from certain sanctions. Our own sanctions and international sanctions imposed by the United Nations Security Council. This relief will be phased as Iran takes steps to adhere to the deal. If Iran violates the deal, sanctions can be snapped back into place. Meanwhile, other American sanctions on Iran for its support of terrorism, its human rights abuses, its ballistic missile program will continue to be fully enforced.
President Obama also underscored the challenges ahead and that the deal is not yet done.
Now, let me reemphasize, our work is not yet done. The deal has not been signed. Between now and the end of June, the negotiators will continue to work through the details of how this framework will be fully implemented, and those details matter. If there is backsliding on the part of the Iranians, if the verification and inspection mechanisms don't meet the specifications of our nuclear and security experts, there will be no deal. But if we can get this done, and Iran follows through on the framework that our negotiators agreed to, we will be able to resolve one of the greatest threats to our security and to do so peacefully.
President Obama must also reassure U.S. allies in Israel and the Gulf Cooperation Council that Washington will hold Iran accountable for fulfilling its commitments, particularly when the elimination of sanctions may provide the Islamic Republic with additional resources to support its destabilizing activities in the region. The president must also repair the bipartisan consensus that has been frayed during the negotiating process. The Congress feels that it has a prerogative to weigh in on the deal. Currently, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker, has sponsored a measure that would establish a framework for congressional involvement. It would block sanctions from being lifted during a 60-day period for congressional review. For more on the many hurdles ahead in reaching a nuclear deal with Iran, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Alex Fatanka is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based here in Washington. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Iran and Pakistan: Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. And Matthew McInnes. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Iran, its intentions, strategic culture, military power, and goals. Before joining AEI, Matthew McInnes served as a senior analyst and in other leadership positions for the U.S. Department of Defense. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Well, Alex Fatanka, let me begin with you. And let me start out with one other actuality from President Obama in lieu of asking you the question.
So when you hear the inevitable critics of the deal sound off, ask them a simple question. Do you really think that this verifiable deal, if fully implemented, backed by the world's major powers, is a worse option than the risk of another war in the Middle East?
All right, Alex. Is it a worse option than another war in the Middle East, or is he setting up a false choice?
Carol, I think the critics of the president would say that he's trying to scare the American public by bringing the notion of war unless we have this deal. But frankly, I think the president makes a fundamentally good point when he says their critics of the deal have so far yet to produce a real alternative to a diplomatic resolution to this Iranian nuclear file. That I have to agree with the U.S. president on. At the same time, we all understand why countries in the region, Israel, the Sunni Arab states and so on, all have concerns about what would this mean for Iran's ability to maneuver its power in the Middle East. That I understand. But what the problem is, those countries, and including U.S. politicians that are against the deal, what they haven't done so far is to put on the table a real, believable alternative to the diplomatic track. And the concern we all have is, unless we can see something we can believe in as an alternative, we all assume at the end of the path there's nothing but military confrontation, and that is where the American public doesn't want to go.
Turning to you, Matthew McInnes, for your answer to that question that President Obama posed, this deal, the diplomatic path, or a potential return to war or military action, which we know will have serious blowback consequences.
Thanks, Carol. And I agree that any type of military action is certainly not a preferred alternative. I disagree, frankly, with some of my colleagues at our institute on this particular issue. But at the same time, I think the president, as Alex, I think, was hinting at, is presenting a false choice between this deal or war. And I think for those of us, you know, among scholars as well as politicians that are looking at this issue and are concerned about some of the aspects of this deal, about some of the assumptions in this deal that may not hold true, that we are necessarily advocating for military conflict, which is absolutely not the case. I think it is difficult to come up with a good alternative because all the alternatives, frankly, are kind of bad. We have a deal here that has basically justifies what Iran has been doing in violation of UN resolutions, in violation of UN sanctions the last few years, in pursuing its enrichment program. We're going to basically justify that at this point. And that's, for me, very problematic as someone who supports nonproliferation efforts within the international community. What I'm concerned about here is that we're not looking to get a better deal. And I think we could get a better deal in this situation. I think we have perhaps conceded too much because we're too afraid that we can't get any kind of deal. And I think we have underestimated the amount of leverage that we have in this situation, that I think the Iranians are very, very anxious to get sanctions relief. And I think they would be willing to go further on their concessions. I think we've been too timid in some ways.
Alex Vatanka, do you think the United States has been too timid? Do you think that we perhaps could get a better deal? I mean, we're not there yet, even though the framework has been established. Is there an opportunity to make some changes up until June 30th in the U.S. negotiating style and substance?
I think it's going to be very hard for the U.S. at this point to make any substantive changes to what's already been agreed on. It's not just because of what the U.S. wants, but the other countries, particularly Russia and China, are willing to go along with, never mind Iranian objections that are almost guaranteed. On the point that Matt makes is about leverage, look, the U.S. leverage is great. There's no doubt about it. But as somebody who looks at the Iranian domestic politics on a daily basis, I am pretty sure that the red line that they had on the Iranian side was the ability to continue enrich uranium, which is one of the key sticking points among the critics. They weren't going to give that up. It has become a national pride issue. The Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would have basically made a political suicide in many ways. Not in the eyes of the Iranian people, who frankly don't really care that much about it, but from his own position as a hardliner, he has been riding the high horse for so long. For him to suddenly come back 12 years after negotiating, never mind the painful financial cost that Iran has to bear because of its refusal to abide by the various UN Security Council resolutions, for him at this very last minute to come in and say we give up on that pivotal issue of enrichment, which, as I said, is what the critics of the deal would want Iran to also give up, that's just not going to happen. Again, takes us back to that simple proposition. If that's not going to happen, then what else can you do to keep diplomacy alive? And that's exactly where I think, going back to what President Obama said, there is no alternative. This is something we had to give, despite the great American leverage. We weren't going to go as far as getting the Iranians to quit enriching uranium.
Sure, but there may be other points. So let me turn to Matthew McInnes. There are two unresolved issues, as I understand it, and they are how long restrictions on Iran's nuclear program will remain in place, and then what sort of nuclear research it will be able to conduct. So perhaps on those two points, could the United States use greater leverage?
Alex, I think, is correct that the actual ability to enrich uranium is probably something that we would never be able to get them completely off of if we were looking for a diplomatic solution. But I do think, as you're pointing out, Carol, there are a number of other issues that we could improve this deal, I think, significantly. One is, you know, the uranium stockpile that the Iranians have. Originally, there was a lot of discussion that that could be exported, that Russia could take that stockpile, and that could be further reduced of what Iran has in country. And that's something that has been taken off the table. We could be looking at a longer, what would they call, the sunset clause, insofar as the duration of the deal. We could be looking at something like what the French were originally proposing of something close to 25 years for some of these restrictive measures. Insofar as resolving, in particular, issues of how fast they can do research and development, which I think is, for me, a very considerable concern, but also, frankly, really coming to terms with the International Atomic Energy Agency's questions about their research into nuclear weapons. I think this is something that it's been unclear to me throughout this entire process. Are we really going to resolve the questions that the IAEA has, or are we just going to settle into this, what I call, comfortable ambiguity, that Iran is never going to fully admit what it has done, and we're not fully going to press them to come clean on everything, and we're just going to agree to disagree? And that's one of my greater fears in this situation, is that we're never going to have that clear baseline of what Iran has been up to all these years.
So you're saying the framework doesn't require that that question be answered?
The objective of the framework is to answer that question. It's just that the process we've had since the interim agreement in November of 2013 has been, we must resolve those issues. But Iran has been very, almost blatantly, you know, throwing off the IAEA's inspectors on this regard, because I think the U.S. has kind of conceded that Iran is never going to fully admit everything, so they're going to come up with some compromise in the end. And that, for me, is very worrisome, especially, again, from a non-proliferation standpoint.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Alex Vatanka. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Matthew McInnes, from whom you just heard, he's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We're discussing the historic framework deal reached by the P5+1 and Iran to curb Iran's nuclear program and the challenges ahead in securing a permanent agreement by the end of June. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter and send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to one of our most faithful Nigerian listeners and Facebook fans, Goodness Chidi. Well, back to you, Alex Vatanket. One more point on the substance of the deal. You know, the Israelis talk about a better deal, and they say that perhaps sanctions should be maintained on Iran until Iran agrees to dismantle more of its nuclear infrastructure. Others say this deal is about as good as it will get. These kinds of demands would be too maximalist for Iran. Is this as good as it gets, given the nature of the regime, in your view?
You know, the issue has become so politicized that if I was Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I understand exactly where it comes from when you listen to some of the rhetoric that comes out of Tehran about the state of Israel, but as a practical step, I would have been probably quiet about what I thought Iran should do, and I would pass that message to the Americans and include that as part of the negotiations with the Iranians, because whatever Israel says publicly once, the Iranians will go out of their way not to deliver on that point, just to make a point that it's not Israel that is getting us to change our ways. Look, something that Matt said earlier, end of the day, there is a real proliferation threat here that could be very costly in not distant future for the entire Middle East, if not the world. That's real, and that had to be removed. And I think that is more important to another point that Matt made, which is what Iran has done in the last few decades on the nuclear weapons program. If we chose to go and insist on that point, to get the Ayatollah to come out and say, you got us red-handed. Yeah, we were working on a weapons program. Again, politically, that's almost inconceivable to see happening. I mean, here's a man, the Grand Ayatollah of Iran, the supreme leader of the land, who has issued fatwas saying we're against a weapon. So for us to push on that point, I think we're going to corner him. And I just don't think that's going to end up in a place that we want to be as the negotiating party, as America working with the Iranians. So I think we have to be practical. We are more concerned about preventing proliferation, keep an eye on what Iran is doing, as opposed to at this point, a moment in time, insisting on them coming out and basically admitting to having pursued a weapons program at one point in the past.
Turning back to you, Matthew McInnes, President Obama also said in his statement after the framework was reached that we only have three options for addressing Iran's nuclear program: a verifiable deal, bomb Iran's nuclear facilities and start another war in the Middle East and set it back only a few years, a fraction of the time of the deal, that is, or just pull out of these negotiations, try to get other countries to, like Israel would like, perhaps to continue sanctions. In that case, that Iran wouldn't capitulate but advance its program and the breakout time would be shortened. What would you say to that?
Well, I mean, if the deal was truly verifiable, I could perhaps go along with that partway. I have concerns in particular, you know, when the president set this up as, you know, if Iran cheats, the world will know. As someone that used to watch these issues very closely inside the U.S. government, I have concerns about the ability for us to really be able to do that. I mean, our intelligence community and our partners around the world that we work with on these issues, as well as the International Atomic Energy Agency and other key players, they do a marvelous job, but it's not been sufficient with Iran so far. We keep getting surprised about what Iran's doing over the last 10 to 15 years. So, you know, if we had a verifiable deal, I could buy what the president is saying. As I said before, I don't support military action in this situation because of the negative consequences that I used to, you know, assist the U.S. military in wargaming these types of scenarios, and it doesn't look good at the end. But in looking towards waiting and going further with sanctions to see if we could get a better deal, that is kind of where I would want to be. If the deal that we're looking at right now is the best that we can get, you know, I think we could go further. I think, frankly, a constructive pause in the negotiations to see if this is really, have a gut check to see if this is really where we want to be, I think we could actually be very useful. I think we underestimate, again, Iran wants this deal more than we do. And I think even if there was a lot of dramatics from taking a break on the negotiations, Iran would want to come back to the table, and I think we would too.
Well, back to you, Alex Vatanka. Something that we hinted at but haven't addressed yet, and that is, of course, the nature of the regime itself being a revolutionary regime, and Iran's activities in the region have really destabilized its neighbors. The Sunni Arab Gulf states, of course, are up in arms, as is Israel. And, of course, the deal doesn't seem to address Iran's meddling in the region. Do you think that unless those activities are also addressed, that really this issue can't be fully resolved?
You know, on the point that Matt made about something that needs to be verifiable, I wonder in the real world, even United States having the ability to verify what some of the closest allies of this country do at all times. Canada, Britain. I mean, there's a history. You can look countries obviously have secrets, even the closest of allies. Iran is not an ally of the United States. In fact, it's one of the biggest adversaries of the United States. But when you think about the alternative, we are not going to get the kind of verifiable mechanisms in place that would satisfy the real critics out there on this deal. But there's another point to this, and that is the U.S. isn't the only party negotiating with Iran in this. And I suspect one of the main fears, and I think is a justified one, is if the U.S. delays it further, if we say we're not going to sign this deal by June, we want a better deal, it's not just whether the Iranians are going to deliver, it's whether parties that have so far been standing with the United States since 2006, as I said earlier, Russia and China in particular, what are they going to walk away from the U.S.? And then Iran will win. Look, we have to remember, Iran couldn't care less about United States sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei can live with U.S. sanctions. He worries about international sanctions. And the key here is, how do you maintain the international coalition intact? It's been proven to have been the most successful part of this whole saga with Iran. Russia and China, if you were sitting in Tehran in 2006, you would have never dreamt that they would vote for 6 U.N. Security Council resolutions against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which they did. But now we have a whole different global landscape. We have Russia and the United States fighting over Ukraine. We've got the Islamic State, which might in some ways make Iran an attractive tactical partner, at least in that fight. So things have shifted. And the question is, what can you do in summer 2015 that best serves the minimal requirements from a U.S. perspective, which is to make sure Iran doesn't weaponize? And I think this deal, it's not the best one. At least a temporary one is probably the best thing we could come up with for now.
All right. Now that you haven't answered my question, I'd like you to answer that, which is, if indeed the deal goes through, Iran will qualify for sanctions relief. The actors in the region, both the Sunni Gulf states and Israel, they are concerned that any windfall from sanctions relief would allow Iran to finance its nefarious activities, whether it's funding Hezbollah, Hamas, which are obviously opposed to Israel's existence, as well as Bashar al-Assad in Syria. What about the sanctions relief and how that would bolster Iran's activities, which will continue to irritate its neighbors?
That's a great unknown. Frankly, I don't think we can tell at this moment how Iran will react in the region post a permanent nuclear deal, because it takes us to something that we actually know not that much about and certainly can't predict, which is that internal Iranian debate. There are two schools of thought in Tehran today. There are those people like Hassan Rouhani, the president, his foreign minister Javad Zarif, who believe that a settlement of the nuclear file is only the first step, and this is something that Iran ought to build on. This is what Hassan Rouhani has been calling for since he became president. We want to go back to the international mainstream. And resolving the nuclear issue is the first, most important, but only first step. But then you have to change your behavior elsewhere, too. He hasn't said it in so many words, but when he speaks about the need to reach out to the Saudis and so on, it clearly shows there is a recognition on the part of at least one faction in the Islamic Republic that they need to go beyond just the nuclear negotiations. But then you have the hardliners in Tehran who believe that, no, things are working out in Iran's favor. There's no need to change strategy. They're winning in Iraq. They're winning in Syria. They don't think the Saudis are going to win in Yemen and so forth. So the question is, who is going to win that debate in Tehran? It's very difficult to predict that one. But I have total sympathy with Iran's immediate neighbors, particularly Israel or Saudi Arabia and others who are concerned about what this deal and sanction relief might do to Iran. But the question, though, is, isn't that a bullet that you basically have to bite? That there is no alternative. They would be worse off if Iran decided to weaponize and go down the path of a nuclear weapon.
Let me turn to Matthew McInnes for your view, Matthew, on how President Obama is going to assuage the concerns of our allies in the region, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and Israel, on this question of sanctions relief and to what extent this will bolster Iran's rise in the region, which is, of course, a major irritant to those parties.
Yes, I think this is one of the concerns that President Obama, I'm hoping, is taking very seriously, that the need to bolster the security worries from Saudi Arabia, from our other Gulf partners, from Egypt, from Israel, they're all very worried about where the region is heading. The region is in a state of conflict that, frankly, it hasn't seen since the end of World War II, and it is making most of the world leaders internationally, as well as leaders there in the region, very nervous. And I think this idea that we're hearing from the administration that, you you know, we can potentially move to a different type of relationship with Iran, that, you know, not that we're necessarily going to become allies of Iran, but that we can move to what I've heard some describe as managed competition, that we can balance Saudi Arabia and Israel and Turkey and Iran so the U.S. does not have to have as much of a direct role. I think the rest of the region doesn't quite know what this means. And certainly in Iran, after a nuclear deal, flush with cash, additional investment coming in, even though, frankly, it's going to take a while before Iran really gets its economic engine up and running, given years of economic difficulties beyond just sanctions and low oil prices. But once that happens, I think that the rest of the region is beginning to figure out, okay, what's next? How do we need to organize ourselves? I think what you're seeing in this conflict in Yemen right now is an indicator of what we may be seeing in the future. Arab coalition that Saudi Arabia has put together is an unprecedented thing. And I think you wouldn't see this if it wasn't for the concerns about where Iran is going with its allies, with its proxy forces and other interests in the region.
Indeed. And of course, we could devote another program to that. So as we conclude, back to you, Alex Vatanka, the Congress. Of course, now they are clamoring for a role. We're looking at a bill by, as I said, Senator Bob Corker that would require the Congress to review the terms of the agreement. What, in your view, should the role of Congress be? And to what extent is it going to be a major impediment and challenge for President Obama?
You know, what's more important in my personal view on this is where does the constitutional arrangement work itself out in this case, because all I hear from the president and members of Congress is disagreement about what constitutional rights they have on this issue. So as an outsider, somebody who's not in the executive branch or in the legislative branch, I look at that very interesting debate and I'm curious where we're going to go, because, I mean, the president maintains he has the power to do this. The Republican presidents before him have signed agreements of this nature. This is not a treaty, as he points out. And, you know, members of Congress who are anti-nuclear deal with Iran beg to differ. So I don't know, but I do know one thing. Once you have a fight at this level within the U.S. government, that doesn't look good for the United States. And again, it gives ammunition to those people who are wondering where the U.S. is going. The Iranian Supreme Leader had a bit of a smirk on his face when he said the letter that the Republican senator sent to him shows that the United States is self-destructing. Now, I think that is very premature to say that, but there is something to that. And you need to agree on some of the key pivotal foreign policy issues at home and face the world with more of a united front than what we've seen so far on this issue.
Turning to you, Matt McInnes, certainly a united front would be ideal, but we're looking at an administration that has constantly been under attack by primarily the Republican members of Congress. Now the Republicans are in control of both houses of Congress, and they are dead set to want to review the deal, somehow either try to dismantle it or undermine it. It's a major challenge, and what Alex said is also of concern. Could the international community collapse if Congress does intervene and tries to meddle?
Well, I think the impasse that you see right now between the president and Congress really stems back to what I consider Obama's not well-informed or well-thought-out strategy towards the legislature to begin with in this process. I think, actually, the president has enormous amounts of leeway to make decisions at the executive level regarding this particular deal. I think in some ways what the Congress is frustrated with is their limited capacity to truly affect what the president is negotiating right now. At the same time, Congress will have to come in at some point because these sanctions are congressional sanctions. And if they're going to be removed permanently, Congress has to take action. What I think what you're really seeing, and why not so much the Republicans, but there's a good number of Democrats that are very concerned about where the president is going on this, is because the president didn't want to work with Congress to begin with. There was a conscious decision that we need to kind of get this deal done and so that it becomes a fait accompli that is really difficult for Congress to work around. And I think that's what's frustrated so many of the Democratic leaders, because frankly, this is one of our most important international negotiations we've had since the end of the Cold War. And it's something that the American people are concerned about. It's something that Congress should have some kind of role because of the importance of this deal. This is not some simple, you know, trade negotiation or anything like that. This is much more significant than that. And I think that's where the president had missteps here, is because he didn't recognize that Congress needs to be part of this process. If we'd had a united front in Switzerland, I think we would have gotten a better deal myself. And I think the president put himself in a bad position because of his congressional strategy.
Well, gentlemen, we will be talking about the politics in the run-up to a final agreement, should there be one, in the many, many weeks and months ahead. Thank you both for joining us. That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Alex Vatanka, scholar at the Middle East Institute, and Matthew McInnes, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Sidrak Franklin, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.